tables. So what I'm going to recommend, and my apologies to Lil, but she's pretty flexible. We'll start, what I'll do is we'll go by row starting from the back, and please try to be as quiet as possible. We were told there'd actually be places to stand, but they blocked them with the tables, so of food. So if the back rows want to just start, and then I'll let the rows know that it's your turn to go up, okay? I'm going to ask Lil to make sure you're, because it's so loud over there, it's not a film, it's actually somebody that's doing what I'm doing, talking like this. If you could be sure, because it's kind of hard to hear in the back if you're not doing that, all right?
Okay, we're very flexible because we're nurses. Our next speaker is Lil Mood. Lil is going to talk to us about identifying potential partners. Howie has already started that, but identifying potential partners in environmental and occupational communities for advocacy efforts with nursing to address global climate change and public health. Lil is a public health nurse. She worked in the field for 32 years as a public health nurse. She is retired and continues to work in the field. So I don't know why we have 32 years. It's 32 years and going. She's worked in home health care and community services with the aging population. She's been a high-level administrator with the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control, and she's been heavily engaged in risk communication and working with the community. She's won numerous awards. It's amazing. She has lots of awards pre-retirement and then a whole bunch of awards post-retirement, so she just keeps going. And what I remember about Lil, so I've been doing this 11 years, well, this part of my life for 11 years, and the first nurse I met in this work was Barb Sattler, and then I think probably the second was I was at a conference and I was still feeling, a little shaky in my new little job here, and there was Lil Mood speaking, and oh my goodness, she is who I've aspired to be since that time. I think she's one of the best storytellers ever, so please welcome Lil Mood.
Now, first tell me how I change my slides. Click on the left here.
Okay.
I think it's just this one. I think it's
the left side? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now you have to go back.
Okay. Got it. I think I can do that. One click. Well, this is going to be a test because I don't think I've ever competed with pasta before. But I'll just keep talking and you all just keep eating and pay attention when you can. When you hear the kind of information that Barb and Howie have given us, I mean, it just makes you want to say, got to do something. Doesn't it make you feel that way? And then, well, what can we do? What can I do? And you've seen some of the list of things that, we say, okay, well, I can change my light bulbs. I can have fluorescent bulbs. I can get a fuel-efficient car. I can combine my trips so I don't go as much. I could take a bus. I could ride a bike. I could walk. But wait a minute. What if you're in a community where there is no public transit, or where the public transit is inadequate to get you to where you need to go, whether it's the frequency of the buses or the destinations or the length of time that they run during the day and night? What if there are no sidewalks or safe spaces that you can walk? What if there are no bike lanes or any provision for any off-road biking? Well, what do we do then? Well, I think what we do is what public health folks always do. You get involved. And so this is not just an individual issue. This is an issue that takes collective action, and that's public health. Well, then the next question is, well, how do I get involved? I can only tell you my own story, and I hope that in telling that story, it will kind of click for you in some ways, maybe not in others, and that it may stimulate you to then figure out how, where you are, that you might get involved. And the starting point for me on what we're now calling climate change I didn't call climate change at all. This was 15 years ago or so when I showed up at to make public comments at a State Department of Transportation on a State Department of Transportation plan. Now, you can translate that into road plan, because all of the focus of the whole plan was, where shall we build new roads? Where shall we widen roads? That was the transportation plan. So I showed up, and my question was, well, what are we doing to decrease the demand for more roads and more road repair? And my proposal was that we use the existing rail lines, there are 9 of them that come into our capital city in South Carolina, that only carry freight, to also carry people. Well, I took my little comments and I distributed them to anybody who would take a copy, and one of the people that I gave them to was my brand new state representative. And one of my colleagues, my public health colleagues and mentor, said to me, you need to get to him. He's young, he's new, he needs a cause, you know, so maybe you can get him into this. So I did. Well, I mean, this guy's now the lieutenant governor, and he's planning to run for governor next time, so you never do know where it's going to go. But talking with him got me appointed to the Department of Transportation's Rail Advisory Committee. And out of that committee came some recommendations that led to a regional council of governments feasibility study on commuter rail service and an appointment to their rail advisory committee. Well, now we've done 2 feasibility studies and are beginning on what's called an alternatives analysis. And all of these are just steps that it takes to get federal funding. Now we're also compiling a list of potential champions so that we can get some influential decision makers to help us back this plan. So I think one of the things we have to do is to get on other people's agenda. So what I did was I took my little commuter rail idea and got on the luncheon circuit in my community. Now, there are lots of civic organizations, and they are all looking for speakers for their programs. The Rotary Club, the Lions Club, the Ruritan, the Women's Club, the Garden Club. Whoever would have me, I'd show up and speak. And mainly, I was painting a vision of what our community and our lives could be like if we had a rail connection to this nearby capital city. And that exposure resulted in my being appointed to the Regional Transit Authority Board. That's the entity that runs the existing bus system. I joined the League of Women Voters, who let me chair their transportation initiative. We convened a wide range of stakeholders, and you need to understand that my definition of stakeholder is anyone whose interest overlaps or connects with the one that I'm working on. And so the good thing about public transportation is that it has so many connections. If you're interested in climate change and reducing air pollution, well, then you've got air regulators and you've got all the environmental groups. If you want to keep the elderly from getting isolated and keep them self-sufficient longer, you've got the AARP and all the aging councils. If you want to provide a way to get people to jobs, then all of the workers and all of the employers and the chambers of commerce are all interested in it. If you talk about getting access to services, all our public health colleagues step up to the plate, the United Way, disabled groups, hospitals, other health providers, and then you always have the elected officials and the planning bodies and all of that. So the League convened about more than 40 people showed up when we sent out an invitation to about 100 folks to just brainstorm what the region needed in public transit and some steps for getting there. And that original brainstorming group has become an email network. Now, we're not organized enough to call ourselves a coalition. I got some great information from the American Public Transportation Association on how to organize a coalition. But at that point, we were so interested in keeping people at the table that we decided not to get that organized, because if we had become an organized public advocacy coalition, the guys at the Department of Transportation wouldn't have been allowed to come. And we wanted to keep everybody at the table. But we do have a mission statement, and we have a set of guiding principles. And so then I began just facilitating an exchange of information via email and phone. And what I do is just make sure that all the people in this network are aware of opportunities to speak or be involved in decisions. And we have more than 100 individuals and organizations in this network. When they get information, then what they do is they go out and mobilize all of their members and friends. So every time a public transportation issue comes up, an opportunity comes up, our elected officials hear from this whole wide range of constituents and not just one advocacy group. I do get invited to meetings and discussions as a contact person for the Midlands Friends of Public Transit. You know, if you have a name and you have a contact person, nobody knows how loosely organized you are. You know, you just show up like you represent a lot of folks. And we do. So then the United Way of the Midlands called to see if I'd serve on their Food, Shelter, Safety, and Transportation Community Council. And I now chair their Transportation Subcommittee. One of the friends I made there represented the Greater Columbia Chamber of Commerce, and I asked him how we could get the business community involved in supporting public transit. And so he arranged to have me make a presentation to the Chamber's Issues Committee. And I took two well-known and respected businessmen with me. That was important. And the Chamber then reactivated their Transportation Steering Committee, asked that I participate in that, and have been an active force in putting public transit on the priority agenda in our area. One of the businessmen who was a mover and shaker in his own community in revitalizing his downtown area has been working on making congressional contacts for support. And I can tell you that his voice carries a lot more weight than mine. We sent a letter to our congressional delegation from 12 organizations and elected officials ranging from the Chamber of Commerce to the United Way to the AARP, asking that they change federal transportation regulations to give mass transit an even playing field. It is a lot easier to get money to build a road than it is to do a mass transit project, and we gave them some details on that. My state representative, who's a longtime friend and a colleague in public health, who ran for the state legislature after he retired, is working with me and another network of supporters on a bill to increase our state's investment in mass transit. In South Carolina, we have a state gasoline tax of 16.75 cents per gallon, and out of that, one quarter of one penny goes to mass transit. So we're trying to get a shift in that. This year was our second round of trying to get a bill passed, and in the second round, we gained some co-sponsors. We changed the shape to have wider appeal, and we made it to the House Ways and Means Committee. So we're going to try again in the upcoming session. And in this legislative effort, what we did was to link with organizations that already had lobbyists. I mean, we can hire a lobbyist, so we just linked with them. So the Conservation Voters and the Transportation Association and the AARP and the Sierra Club all have lobbyists, and so we just got our bill on their legislative agenda so they could work it for us. And now we are working on doing the same thing with the State Chamber of Commerce and making some inroads. Our regional transit system is sadly underdeveloped and has a fast approaching funding crisis. Richland County Council, that's the home of the state capitol, provided some interim funding and appointed a study commission to produce a comprehensive transportation plan with a plan for funding. Lexington County Council, that's my home county, that's the next adjacent county, was allowed one seat on the Transportation Study Commission. So I went to them and asked them if I could fill in that seat, and they said yes. You know, there wasn't a long line of people asking to do that, so they appointed me. And that's given me a link for an ongoing relationship with the county council members and the county administrator. Meanwhile, back at home in my community, I worked with a friend and a neighbor to get sidewalks on our major thoroughfares. We made a start, and then we participated in the town's planning charrette, developing a master plan for growth and development in our community. And now I serve on what's called the 2016 committee. That's a community group charged with implementing that plan. And I've been chairing a subcommittee focused on building connecting roads with sidewalks and bike lanes to make our community make it more possible to get around our community without having to get into a car for every trip. Now, I'm telling you all of this so that you will see how easy it is to get involved. The hard part is the persistence required to make significant long-term changes. We don't have any passengers on our rails yet. Our first road project failed when the town council balked at using their right of eminent domain for the final link, that last little parcel that was a piece of property that was in probate, and there were 9 siblings involved. Now, we had all the affected property owners on the committee, including the executor of that estate, but at the end, they didn't buy in, and it fell through. The sidewalk project ran out of money, so now we're having to start that up again. The transportation study proposal was rejected by county council. The legislative bill got stuck in committee. I mean, community advocacy can be discouraged. This is not work for the faint of heart. And I said the magic words earlier, and that is long term. I'm not doing this just for me or even for my community's immediate benefit. I'm doing this work for our children and our grandchildren. I'm working from the rule of 7 that the Native American communities employ. You know, that what we do, we've got to do thinking about the impact on the 7th generation. Now, every step that I've mentioned has a story all its own, and I mean, I'll be glad to bend your ear about that over pasta anytime you want to, if you could stand to hear anymore. But I do want to just leave you with a summary, just a short list of advice. The first thing is, just show up. I love quoting Marla Salmon when she says the world is run by people who show up. Next, get involved in ever-widening circles of contacts. Stay focused. Don't spread yourself too thin. You know, if you're active and visible, there are all kinds of people who want you to take up their causes. Resist that. You know, try to stay with the thing that you started with. Build allies, not adversaries. Communicate, because information empowers people to take action. Be persistent, but not obnoxious. And even if you get discouraged, don't give up. Take the long view and remember that you can make a difference. And good luck.
Hi, everybody. Okay, now what did I do to the microphone, Liz? I went to adjust it, so.
On the face, there's a button.
That says push. Oh, very clever. I'm sort of the taskmaster of the group, so I just wanted to make sure that sign-up sheet that we sent around is still moving. Does everybody sign this? Okay, that's great. I have the great pleasure to introduce the very last speaker on the program, and that's Dr. John Balbus. Dr. Balbus is the chief scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund. He's a physician and public health professional, and he works on a very broad range of environmental health issues, including air pollution, the built environment, climate change, nanotechnology, toxicology, and antibiotic resistance. Prior to joining the Environmental Defense Fund, Dr. Balbus was on the faculty of the George Washington University Schools of Medicine and Public Health, where he was the founding director of the Center for Risk Science and Public Health and founding co-director of the Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment. He's board certified in both internal medicine and occupational and environmental medicine. Dr. Balbus combines his experience as a clinician with his expertise in environmental health sciences, and he's currently a member of the National Academy of Science Board on Environmental Studies and Toxicology and the Institute of Medicine Roundtable on Environmental Health Sciences Research and Medicine, as well as the Environmental Protection Agency's Children's Health Protection Advisory Committee. And I welcome Dr. Balbus to the podium for a really wonderful presentation. I've had the opportunity to preview.
I need my mouse to work. There it is. Okay. Thank you so much, Steph.